The following audio program is suitable for all ages. It's July 24th, 2005, and you're tuned in to the RetroBits Podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Earl Evans. So step away from that 3 gigahertz number cruncher and come back with us to the nice cool breeze of megahertz and kilobytes. If it's got 8 bits, cartridge slots, paper tape, CPM, BASIC and ROM, or if it's just plain old, then you've found the right podcast. How's everybody doing this week? Gosh, it's show number 4. This is pretty exciting. We're really on a roll now. This week's been pretty busy for me. I might have mentioned that this last weekend we had some visitors that were here from out of town. It's our second set of visitors in a row. Actually came in their RV and stayed with us for a couple days. That was a lot of fun. I was noticing on show number 3, I'd recorded that show pretty early on Sunday morning. And when I went back and listened to the audio, I sounded really tired. Hi, this is RetroBits. Thanks for tuning in. So anyway, I guess next time if I'm doing the show and I'm kind of beat like that, I'm going to make sure that I have some coffee nearby just in case. But anyway, the visit went really well. And our first set of friends that had come the weekend before made it back home. And my friend Tony's a web designer. And so when he got back, he took the photographs that they had taken on their journey and he made some flash animations with sound and that, and he sent me the URL. I'm telling you, it was just hilarious. There were some pictures of my family in there that were captioned with funny captions, and Tony's really a kick. He's one of the people that I worked with back in the 80s when we were selling the Atari 8-bit systems. So thanks for the laugh, Tony. I appreciated that. This last week also, my kids finished their swimming class. And in their last swimming session, they got to go down the big water slide. I didn't know if my son would do it. I mean, he loves going down, but it's kind of intimidating when you get way up there and you're looking down. But yeah, he did it. In fact, he did it multiple times. And my daughter, who has absolutely no fear, I mean, it's the word is not even in her vocabulary, either vocabulary, Chinese or English, both of which she speaks. She just barreled down the slide multiple times. And anyway, it was fun seeing them have a good time. Another thing that was fun this last week, I got a couple of emails, some letters. I'm pretty excited about this. Thank you guys for, shooting me these emails and letting me know that you're listening to the show and giving me some suggestions. I got an email from Laura and she mentioned that she likes the Atari computers and grew up with that. And she also sent me some really good sites. And I've got URLs for these retro computing sites up on the show notes. I'll just talk about a couple of them real quick. One is a site that I've had an awful lot of fun with, especially over the last few weeks. On the archive.org website, which archives media of a variety of kinds, they have the entire run, I think it's the entire run, of the show Computer Chronicles. Now, you may have seen this show while it was actually being produced from the mid-80s up until the late 90s. The show focused on computer issues, and it is really fun to go back to the archives and take a look at those episodes in the modern-day context. I mean, when they were making the show, it was new technology, but now, of course, it's retro from our perspective. And some of the personalities you would recognize, some you might not. It's definitely interesting hearing them talk about where they think the future of technology is going and trying to see whether or not they pegged it or if they were way off the mark. Seemed like at least one of the shows, if not a couple of them, had Jack Tramiel on there, the person who'd founded Commodore and then eventually moved off and purchased Atari. He is a very intriguing character. It's just interesting to see him on those shows. Other than those shows, I don't know of any other place where I could actually go and watch historical footage of Tramiel. So anyway, check that out. Computer Chronicles on the archive.org site. Lots of fun. Also some retro gaming sites. One of them was the Classic Gaming Expo. And this is an event that is like one of the festival style shows that I've talked about in the past. And they focus on classic gaming. And from what I understand, there's both gaming consoles and the retro computers that are represented in that expo. And another is Digital Press, and it's the same sort of thing. It involves retro gaming. So be sure and check those out, especially you retro gaming enthusiasts out there. I know there's plenty of you out there. One other thing, the BBS site, and again, I'm going to have a link to this, but Laura also forwarded me info on a site where you can access a database of 75,000, over 75,000, in fact, BBSs that existed from the 80s all the way up until modern day. And that just sounds fantastic, especially for people who were really into the BBS scene. I know that was extremely popular. A good friend of mine ran a very popular BBS in the Southern California area. Now, I did go to the site, and I didn't find his BBS in the directory, so I'm going to have to get on him to go to this site and actually put in the information on his BBS. I'm sure that a lot of people would recognize it. It was called Bloom County. When I went to this BBS site, I noticed that there were actually lots of BBSs that were named Bloom County. I'm pretty sure quite a few people would remember his. And so I am going to elbow him to get in there and enter it into the database. I got another letter, email from Wade and Valerie from Morocco. And it's really fun to know that my show is being heard. Yeah, I mean, with the internet, there's really no borders, no limits, but it's just fun to get an email from somewhere exotic and far away. And so I appreciate that. Thanks for sending the email, and I hope you enjoy the show. Now, one of the things that I noticed is that I had a comment on my blog site where I post the podcasts, retrobits.libsyn, LIBSYN.com. And the comment was on our first show, the VIC-20 show. And the commenter pointed out that I had missed referencing a very popular VIC-20 community forum site. And I appreciate somebody pointing that out to me. I didn't actually know about that site. It's called Denial. And the URL for that site is in the show notes. I went to that site and registered and looked, and they have active, vibrant discussion forum going on there about a variety of topics and focusing on the VIC-20. So thank you guys for pointing me to that. I appreciate it. One of the things I'm going to do this coming week, and I'll have more news for you on next weekend's podcast, is look up information on the KFest festival. It's a Apple festival style show. Some people had posted some things about this on the Usenet groups, and I want to go back and see if there's additional information that I can get on this, find out how the show went. So that's my news for this week. Like I had said in the intro, I didn't have any, I'm not sure if I did say this in the intro. I said it on the show notes. I don't really have a central topic for today's show because there were a variety of things that I've been wanting to talk about, and none of them are big enough to really fill up a whole show. So I just decided to sprinkle a whole bunch of things into this show, and we'll see where it takes us. One is I wanted to talk about the UCSD P system. It was a computing environment and most notably an integrated Pascal compiler that was developed at the University of California in San Diego. I used this system in the early 80s. I find out that it was actually developed in the 70s. And the reason that UCSD developed it is they wanted to have a good Pascal environment for educational purposes. I used the UCSD P system on the Apple II computer. Because I worked in computer retail, I usually had access to a pretty wide variety of computer technology, which was kind of the point of working in computer retail for me. I wanted to be in that environment. I was also in college at the time, and Pascal was the language that my university used for their instruction. And the UCSDP system was a fantastic tool for me to use for doing some of my college work and for getting more familiar with Pascal. There's a couple of links in the show notes. One link is called the UCSDP System Museum, and it's got some historical information about the P system. Another link, last October, I think, if my memory serves, it's getting kind of late here. It's actually a quarter of 10 p.m. While I'm doing the show, so my brain is rattling around in my skull. But it seems like October 2004, there was a reunion of some of the original people who were on the team that developed the UCSDP system. You'll find this link on the show notes. There's some videos that they took when they had this reunion. Some of the original people who developed this are on these videos, and the insights on the videos is just really entertaining to watch them come back and talk about this system. I would actually love it if there was some sort of an emulator or way that I could go back and run the UCSDP system today on modern technology. Now, I do actually have it on my Apple II computer, so I can run it like I ran it back in the day. And that is certainly a good amount of fun. But it looked like on the site that there might be some licensing issues with them releasing the UCSDP system. Not sure exactly what was going on there, although I do know that the technology is pretty old at this point, so it seems like they ought to be able to release that. One of the interesting challenges about retro computing in general, I've mentioned this before, is the concept that the old software is still licensed. It's still, in many cases, intellectual property that belongs to someone. So you can't freely distribute it, other than, I mean, people do, and under the concept of abandonware, thinking this is really old and nobody cares about it anymore. And that concept is actually kind of controversial in the computing community. And I don't know exactly how to deal with this, but I don't know what I would recommend to the powers that be. But I do know this. It's important to catalog this software, to keep some interest in it, to keep it alive, because it is tremendously valuable from a historical perspective. And like I said in another podcast, I'm sure that a lot of this software has already hit the landfill and is just gone forever. That's really unfortunate, because this represents quite a evolution in society. Personal computing, it's kind of a big deal. You know what I mean? So, got to figure out some way to keep this stuff, to catalog it, to be able to distribute it, but at the same time to not run afoul of intellectual property and other things like that. Man, that could open up a whole can of worms, so please don't flame me on that. I mean, I know people have very strong opinions from one side to the other on that, and not trying to necessarily put my stake in the ground on that. I'm just saying it is something that we got to think about. Okay, so very jagged segue here, switching gears to a whole nother topic, collecting old computers. Now, a few years ago, I had run the RetroBits.com website, and I was trying to make a go of it, and for a variety of reasons, I had to backpedal away from that, but kind of kicking it back into gear here with the RetroBits.com and the RetroBits podcast. But way back when, I think it was around the year 2000, I had put a survey up on the internet asking people about their collecting habits, collecting old computers. How do they collect them? How do they restore them? And a good number of people responded. I was looking back over some of that material just recently, and there were some interesting insights that I think are still valuable to think about today. For instance, if you're wanting to collect retro computers, one of the best things that you can do is let your friends and family know that you're interested in old computers, because more often than not, they're going to have things in their attic or cellar or things collecting dust in a closet, and they would be more than happy to get rid of those devices. And in some cases, those devices are really cool and have a lot of value. If nothing else, just collectible value. So definitely let people know that you're interested in vintage computing. I know it might be a little nerdy, and, you know, I can appreciate that. On the other hand, by letting people at my work know that I did this, I had some great friends at work, and I let them know that I was interested in vintage computing, and all kinds of fantastic things came out of their attic. One thing that I got was an IBM portable computer. It was IBM's answer to the Compaq. Amber screen, dual floppy drives, and an 8088. Kind of like taking a PC XT and cramming it into a portable case. And that computer is a lot of fun to drag out and play around. Another one that I got was a Radio Shack Microcolor Computer 10, one of the Tandy systems with a whopping 4K of RAM. And that computer is a lot of fun too. And there have been others as well. So anyway, let people know. Another cardinal rule that I heard is not to turn anything down. Now, I know at first that sounds like, wow, where am I going to put everything? But just about anything that you get, you could find a home for if you don't want to be the ultimate owner of it. But if you start being picky and turning things down, then people are going to lose interest in trying to dig up stuff for you. So anyway, your mileage may vary. But that's one thing that I've been told. Don't turn stuff down. Now, if you're actually going to go proactively out to collect these things, where can you find them? One place is at garage sales, although I will tell you from some personal experience, if you go out garage sale hunting for vintage computers, be prepared to spend a whole lot of time finding absolutely nothing, because most garage sales are clothes and toys and crafts, and you're not really going to find vintage computers there. I had an interesting experience. One time, the neighborhood that I was in had a collective garage sale. And when I showed up to work my shift at the booth, I noticed that there was some Commodore computer equipment sitting there. And I said to the person who was near it, I said, are you selling that? And he says, oh, no, I'm just trying to give this away. Do you know anyone who wants it? Well, ding, 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 a winner. I did indeed know somebody who wanted it. So you can luck out at garage sales, not too often, though. So be prepared for a good amount of work. Another place is at swap meets. Now, you guys tell me, do they even hold these things anymore, swap meets, where people get together at, like, a drive-in theater grounds or some other kind of parking lot, and people bring their wares, and everybody swaps? It's kind of a misnomer because people really don't swap. It's more like a buy meet than it is a swap meet. But sometimes you will find vintage computer equipment there. What did they call them across the pond? Was it a car boot sale? And the first time I heard that phrase, I thought, what in the world are they saying? But I think that's analogous to a swap meet. So folks listening from Europe, from other places, let me know. Car boot sale, did I get that right? eBay's another place. Now, there are good things and bad things about buying vintage computers from eBay. Good things include that there's usually a good selection. You can almost always find what you're looking for, especially if you're patient. You also have eBay's feedback mechanism and other recourse mechanisms to fall back on if somebody tries to cheat you or doesn't treat you right in the transaction. The downside is, because people want to sell this equipment, they will usually overemphasize either the rarity or the condition of the computer. They're going to paint the best possible picture they can to make you want to buy this computer that they're selling on auction. So you do have to be careful on that. And the other thing is, they can be kind of expensive on eBay. Certainly, it's more expensive to buy a computer or peripheral equipment off eBay than it is to have your friends give it to you for free because it's collecting dust in their closet. But it is an avenue, and I have purchased computers off eBay, and while I did get burned once with somebody who didn't package the computer well enough, oh man, I tell you, I was just seeing red. I'd even said in the email that I sent them, please make sure to package this properly. And when I got it, I found out they just put the computer in the box with no packing underneath it. And of course, in shipment, it had been damaged and, horrible story. Most of the time, though, I've had good luck from eBay. So there you go. Okay. Again, totally switching gears, in a non sequitur, you know, perpendicular right-hand turn direction. I was trying to figure out, should I sell my HP 41CX calculator? Now, if you're not familiar with this guy, it's a alphanumeric programmable calculator. The language that these calculators understood was pretty extensive for the time. When you look at the language, it almost represents a kind of macro assembler sort of language construct. And I did a whole bunch of programming on this computer back in the early 80s when I bought mine. And I'd found another one, as luck would have it, in brand new condition later on in my life, and I picked that up, and it was the extended model, the 41CX with oodles of memory and that kind of thing. I don't really play with it a lot, though, and that was part of the problem. I know that 41CXs go for usually a pretty good price on eBay, and I could use the money for either other vintage computer stuff or to put in my piggy bank and save up for the trip that I want to take to the Vintage Computer Festival. So I've been trying to figure this out. Anyway, today I think I finally decided. I picked up some N-cell batteries for it at the Fry's Electronics, a local electronics and computer retailer. I popped them in. You know, I've got the books for this thing. They're in pristine condition, and I really like this old calculator. So while I could have some money in my pocket, I think I'm going to keep it. It doesn't take up much room, unlike some of my other vintage equipment, so... Anyway, que sera, I guess I won't have those dollars to play with. Now, looking at the VIC-20 forum website that I was talking about, the denial site, rekindled an interest that I've had over the last few weeks here, actually ever since I did show one and while I was doing the preparation for it. I would like to do some programming for the VIC-20. Now, you might ask, why? Why do I want to haul out a computer with a built-in 5K of RAM and do programming for it? Well, you might ask the other people who are doing that, because quite a few folks are. For me, it's the challenge. I like the fact that I would be working with an extremely small memory footprint and a limited number of characters in that, and see what I could actually do with a computer that would be fun. I might also want to do the same thing with my Atari 400, which has the stock 16K of RAM in the computer. It's only one problem. With the VIC-20, I've got ways to save the programs off to like a standard PC computer or to a disk drive. With the Atari 400, the only thing that I've got is the Atari 410 cassette recorder. So I'm not sure if I want to put myself through the pain of trying to load and save programs from cassette. That just, I don't know, that's maybe a little too retro for me. Laura had mentioned in the email a cable that I've seen before that hooks the old Atari 8-bit computers to your PC, called a SIO to PC cable. The one thing that I don't know is whether or not this cable will work with an Atari 400. I seem to remember that the Atari 400 couldn't be connected to one of the 810 disk drives because it didn't have enough RAM to deal with the DOS that you would need for interacting with the drive. But Atari experts could probably correct me if I'm wrong. The Atari 400 is kind of an odd member of my collection. Most of my stuff and expertise is from the Commodore world, but I may give this a shot. We'll see. One of the things I want to do with the VIC-20 is dig into the Programmer's Reference Guide, which is a fantastic book. I mean, it covers everything all the way from the bits and bytes and peaks and pokes to an actual schematic diagram, if you want to go that crazy. And I will be going to that denial forum, which I'm now registered on, and maybe chatting with some folks there about programming. Switching back for just a second to the UCSDP system, one of the things that they said was a challenge for them was that they only had 64K of RAM, and in that 64K, they had to put a compiler, a editor like an IDE environment, and the P System Interpreter, which was a virtual machine technology, kind of like the granddaddy of what you might see today in Java or .NET. And it sounded like it was challenging to fit all that stuff into the memory footprint that they had to work with. And that's just the kind of thing that makes me think it would be fun to crank out some stuff for the VIC-20. So here I go. It's going to take up some time, but it's going to be a lot of fun. All right, another random segue. If you've got some time on your hands to do some reading and you want to pick up a book on the history of personal computing, one of the first places that I would stop is the book called Fire in the Valley. I've read this book a couple times. I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to read it again. In a subsequent podcast, I will do a more comprehensive book review on this. But trust me, if you want to know about this stuff all the way back from the Altair and the IMSI, Kromenko, processor technology, a lot of the names that were early in the computer, the microcomputer field, then run, don't walk, to wherever you can pick up a copy of this book. It's also got some great photographs in it. If I remember right, the second edition even has a CD with some resources on there. So, got to get this book. If you're a retro computing fan, this is an absolute must. Obviously, you can get it on Amazon. There's other places. So, go get this book. Really, you're going to like it. So, a book that's not quite out yet, but one that I'm interested in, is, let me see, what's the title here? The Spectacular Rise and Fall of Commodore. And you can look at www.commodorebook.com to get more information on this. It hasn't quite gone to press. Looks like it will any day. Now, there's not much on Commodore historically. There was a book called The Home Computer Wars, if I'm remembering right. That thing is out of print, and anywhere that does have a copy wants to charge you $200 for it. It's kind of tough to get your hands on. And it was written in the mid-80s, so it didn't have an opportunity to cover some of the stuff that happened at Commodore after that. This book features interviews and perspective from a lot of the people who worked at Commodore back in the day. And some of the people who are big names in the Commodore fan environment have said that they've seen some chapters of this, kind of a pre-review, and they like what they saw. So when that book comes out, I'm probably going to have to pick up a copy. It looks like it's a little expensive for just casual reading. I mean, I expect technical books to cost a decent amount of money. Usually when it's just a pleasure reading book, it's a little bit cheaper, but you know, I'm so wild about Commodore, it's kind of my thing. I'm going to have to pick this up. So, let me see, where am I at in my show notes here? Yeah, there was just one more thing I wanted to talk about, and it looks like I've got a couple minutes left. I'm interested in asking you folks, the listeners, what was your favorite BASIC, the BASIC programming language, of the different retro computers that you either play with today or that you played with back then? What BASIC language did you like the best? One of the noteworthy things about the early computers is that they all came with some flavor of BASIC or another. Some of the BASICs were more limited. I know on the Commodore, the VIC-20 and the Commodore 64 has a BASIC language that has a couple of mathematical functions that are interesting, but otherwise it was just okay as a BASIC language. It wasn't great. It wasn't terrible. It wasn't the worst one that I've ever seen. But I'm interested, what BASIC did you like? What do you think was noteworthy? Some of the BASICs were purely contained in ROM, while on some of the other computers, they were disk-based BASIC languages, which in some cases meant that they had extensions and other niceties, and some of them got pretty complex. The BASIC that was on the Radio Shack TRS-80 was always one of my favorites. It had good disk input-output functions. I think on CPM there was a variant that was close to this called MBASIC. I run that every now and then on the Commodore 128 in CPM mode. Had a lot of functions that were good for a business environment. I don't know that it would have been a great BASIC for programming games, certainly not for graphical-style games. Seems to me And boy, I'm really dusting off some brain cells here, but it seems like AppleSoft Basic had a variety of good graphic statements in that language. And of course, the Commodore 128, by the time they got to that flavor of Basic with Commodore, they'd done quite a bit with the graphical functions. So I always liked the graphics and sound, and in some of the Basics, it was just tough to get to that stuff. Send me some email. Let me know about your experiences with the Basic language, what you like best. And now, of course, my plug that I give at on every show. On any topic, I would love to hear from you. It was fun having some emails. I'd love to have some more. Email lots, email often. And the email address for the show is retrobits@gmail.com. That's retrobits, R-E-T-R-O-B-I-T-S, at gmail, gmail.com. As always, you can find out about the show, the current and past episodes, at the podcast site, retrobits.libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N.com. Our main website is www.retrobits.com. Right now, that site is just a link to a couple different places, including where the podcasts are kept. Over time, I may be able to extend that website into a discussion forum and a blog and some other things. At the moment, it's been just enough having my hands full to put the podcast together. But, you know, as time goes on, we'll see what happens. Not ruling it in or out. But let me know if that'd be something you'd be interested in. I mean, one of the things that I've thought is that between the old computers website and some of these other websites that specialize on a particular computing company or platform, seemed like that there was already a good amount of sites out there that deal with retro computing. I'm not sure having yet another one would add any value, but if there's a particular thing you think would be a good idea, again, let me know, retrobits@gmail.com. And we're done with show number 4. Hope you enjoyed this random rant that I did today. Just kind of, you know, as my brain bounced around in my head, I just wanted to talk about a few things. And next week we'll probably get back to the idea of having a main show concept and, as always, the news and your emails and etc. So I hope you all have a great week. I'm rebooting for now. Thanks for listening.